here at the University of Toronto, Scarborough, and I'm also the co-director of the Environmental Governance Lab at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. I've also, I'm a member of the Divestment and Beyond group, an alliance of students, faculty, and staff that are interested in just transition and divestment. And I also served on the president's ad hoc committee to consider divestment back in 2014 and 2015. We've got a great panel for you today. We're going to be talking, giving some of the basics of divestment, since the real genesis of this panel is that U of T announced a couple of weeks back now that that it was going to divest its endowment. Explore the basics of divestment to make sure everybody sort of understands what's going on there. And then talk about what it means for U of T and what's next, right? Now that U of T has decided to divest, now that divestment has become sort of more common in societal lexicon, what's next? If divestment catches on and starts to really become, have a great deal of momentum, what do we do with movements of capital to forward goals of climate action and just transition? I've got two great panelists joining me today. Rivka Getz is an undergraduate student at U of T and also a member of LEAP, and I'm going to let her introduce herself a little bit more fully, as well as Professor Paul Downs from the English department, who's also been a key member and active in the divestment movement at U of T. And so the order of our panel is Rivka's going to give us Divestment 101 and talk a little bit about what LEAP has been doing around divestment. Paul is going to talk about the divestment and beyond and what the divestment announcement coming out of U of T sort of means and what comes next there. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the broader context of U of T's divestment and what happens next. And also thinking about the broader context of divestment as a movement. We're going to have plenty of time for Q&A. I think that our presentations will take us about 40-45 minutes in total, and then we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. And I think that's really important because this is a moment, right? This is a moment where U of T is changing direction, and we need to think about what changing direction towards what. And this is also a moment where societally, the financial sector is changing direction. And I think that there has to be a societal discussion about changing direction. In what way is the financial sector going to be changing direction and toward what ends? And so we'll be really looking forward to having a fulsome discussion of divestment at U of T and divestment as a broader phenomenon, as a broader topic. If you have questions that come up during the course of the presentations, I'd ask you to please use the Q&A function, and I will sort of keep track of those, and I will moderate the discussion that we have after the presentations. If you happen to put them in the chat, that's also all right. I'll be monitoring both the chat and the Q&A. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rivka. Why don't you give people a little more sense than I did of who you are? And then looking forward to hearing you tell us about Divestment 101.
Thank you so much, Matthew. And thank you to, oh, are we echoing a little bit? I think we're good. Thank you so much, Matthew, and to the organizers of the Minden Symposium for having us here today. I am really excited to be giving a quick Divestment 101 overview and even more excited to hear the rest of the conversation we're gonna have about where we go as students and faculty and community members at U of T now that we are finally divesting our endowment, and more broadly, where we go after divestment with the climate justice movement. So as Matthew said, I am in my fourth year of undergraduate studies at U of T, and I'm a member of LEAP U of T, which is a student group working towards climate justice, and more specifically, since 2017, we have been raising awareness among students of the fossil fuel divestment campaign, which has actually been going for much longer. And so as a part of my presentation, I'm gonna give a quick history of divestment at U of T and what that has looked like over the years. Prior to the pandemic, LEAP did a lot more in-person direct action, as you can see in the picture here. Since that was not possible so much in the past year and a half, we pivoted to educational events, webinars, trying to start conversations among students and other U of T stakeholders about the fossil fuel industry and U of T's stake in it. And we are so excited that as of last month, the university has finally committed to divesting its endowment, but there is still a lot of work to be done, and that is why we're here today to talk about this. I am going to start with just a bit of a basic explanation of divestment in case anyone is unfamiliar. Divestment involves the removal of investments from funds or direct holdings that support a particular industry or company, often for moral reasons. In the case of fossil fuel divestment, those moral reasons being tied to the climate crisis and trying to stop it or slow it down. It aims to remove the social license of the fossil fuel industry by forcing institutions we have at stake in to take a stand. And when we talk about social license, I'm referring to the acceptance and approval that a society or community has for fossil fuel companies. We want to be decrediting the fossil fuel industry as a whole and moving our economy and our society away from a reliance on fossil fuels. Divestment is about the environment and it's about ethics, but the reason that it's such an important tactic in the climate justice movement is really tied to power. We want to be minimizing the power that fossil fuels have over our economy and our society and our culture. And we do that by leveraging the power that large institutions like U of T, but not just universities, also banks, government institutions, other major charitable institutions, the power that these have in defining our individual and collective futures and our values as a society and the way that we conceptualize fossil fuels and other energy sources. So the theory of change behind this tactic is that if we organize enough students, as well as faculty and staff, my two co-panelists today, to demand divestment, then our universities will have no choice to divest. And if enough campuses divest from the fossil fuel industry, then public opinion will shift against it. And if public opinion shifts away from support of the fossil fuel industry, then the fossil fuel industry will not be as powerful, and that is how we can build a more just future. So while divestment has been the main focus of LEAP U of T over the past few years, it has never been the be-all, end-all of our group or of the movement for climate justice. It is very much a first step towards building a just transition, and that's why we still have lots left to do. So to go quickly over the history of divestment, the fossil fuel divestment campaign was actually not the first time that divestment has been used and strategized at U of T. In the 1980s, the Anti-Apartheid Network was a student group that campaigned for the university to divest from South African apartheid. And that campaign very much laid the groundwork for a lot of the work that LEAP has done and how the university responds to and thinks about divestment. And in 2006 to 2007, there was another successful campaign for divestment from the tobacco industry. So in 2012 and 2013, when a climate justice group called Toronto 350 started campaigning for fossil fuel divestment, they were very much following in the footsteps of these previous student activists. So in 2014, the original petition was submitted by Toronto 350 telling the university that it needed to pay attention to the role of fossil fuel investments in the climate crisis. And in response, President Mary Gertler formed the advisory committee, which spent a year researching and released their report in 2015 endorsing divestment. This report is a really wonderful, well-written report. I have great respect for Matthew Hoffman and the other people who worked on it. And it should have been listened to by the university all the way back in 2015. But in 2016, Merritt Gertler rejected this report and released his own white paper called Beyond Divestment, which I think is very ironically titled, since he was claiming to go beyond something that the university hadn't done in the first place. And in response to this rejection, students at U of T formed a chapter of the LEAP, the group that we now call LEAP U of T, to keep the momentum going and keep conversations going about divestment, even though it had already been rejected at an administrative level. And so our group spent the next few years launching new petitions, campaigns at some of the colleges, rallies and protests, submitting a FIPA request, and doing solidarity work on other issues intersecting with the climate crisis, trying to keep the momentum going. In 2019, we formed the Divestment and Beyond Coalition, which includes faculty and staff, as well as student activists. And finally now, 2021, just a few weeks ago, Merritt Gertler has announced that U of T will divest its endowment by 2030. Just to give a brief overview of how investments and therefore divestment work at U of T, while it is a public institution, its money and investments are managed by a private corporation called University of Toronto Asset Management, or UTAM, which, as you can see here, is directed by the Governing Council of U of T and then hires external investment managers who oversee the various portfolios that U of T is invested in. The majority of U of T's funds are invested indirectly. So in the recent announcement, we saw a 12-month timeline for the removal of direct investments in fossil fuel companies, whereas the timeline for removing indirect investments is actually 9 years long. They're saying they will remove indirect investments by 2030, which is a much longer period than we've seen from a lot of other on-divestment commitments, especially from other Canadian universities. And I'm just pointing this out because I think that 12-month timeline sounds really good, but the actual scope is much broader than that because direct investments make up a much smaller proportion of the endowment. And we don't know exactly how much smaller because there hasn't been a great amount of financial transparency from U of T and from UTAM. In 2019, LEAP submitted a FIPA request through U of T's Freedom of Information Office. And I'm bringing this up because I think it's really relevant to talk about the lack of financial transparency, especially for students, to be able to do work on divestment. We submitted multiple appeals after this request, and UTAM continued to deny it and to refuse to make their investment information public. So all of the information that we've had and that we will continue to have as we gauge U of T's response to the climate crisis and hold them accountable to this commitment that they have now made to divest their endowment, all that we have to go on is the very limited publications that they have made about investments and their environmental initiatives. To that point, for years, greenwashing tactics have been used at U of T to depoliticize their decision not to divest. There is an investment policy laid out by Merritt Gertler in that Beyond Divestment report from 2016, which was continued by UTAM's Responsible Investing Reports, the Investing to Address Climate Change Charter, and the University Network for Investor Engagement. So these are all sustainability initiatives that we saw published by the university and promoted as examples of U of T being a quote-unquote climate leader between that 2016 rejection of divestment and this most recent announcement in 2021. All of these initiatives address carbon emissions, but not the root cause of fossil fuels, because they are investing based on an unstandardized self-reported ranking system known as ESG, Environmental, Social, and Governance Factors, which is really great in theory, but actually has very little accountability because it relies on self-reported statistics. So it gives agency to the fossil fuel industry, which for decades has been funding disinformation campaigns and spending millions of dollars on lobbying and elections to maintain the status quo of resource extraction. So any investment policy relying on self-reporting from fossil fuel companies that allows for continued investment in fossil fuels is really not taking the bold action that we need at this point in the climate crisis. So these are some examples of the marketing that we saw from U of T between 2016 and 2021, showing how they wanted to be seen as being, you know, aware of the climate crisis and sustainable their investing. But actually, many of these measures lacked accountability. Some of them have been very meaningful in reducing carbon emissions from campus infrastructure, the Low Carbon Action Plan that's in the upper right-hand corner here. But they really pale in comparison to the scope of what we're now seeing from U of T's divestment commitment, because the divestment movement operates at a global scale, and so we're looking at decrediting an entire industry as opposed to just the carbon emissions from on-campus infrastructure and architecture. Also, many of these initiatives were used to deflect attention from the administration's ongoing rejections of divestment. So this sudden 180 that we've seen, where U of T is now embracing divestment as a way to be more sustainable, is moving our culture and our economy away from reliance on fossil fuels, or at least finally starting to do that. This announcement is a huge step forward, and I and all of the other organizers at LEAP are really excited about it. But we want to make sure everyone knows that this is not the end of divestment organizing at the university. The announcement framed the decision as a result of the urgency of the climate crisis. But of course, I'm sure anyone who is at this event is well aware that the climate crisis has been urgent for a long time. And there was no acknowledgement of the strong stance against divestment that U of T has held for many years. In some ways, the announcement continues the trend of greenwashing by upholding some of those previous initiatives that lacked accountability as somehow comparable to the impact of divestment. And it doesn't acknowledge the role that fossil fuel corporations have had in land disputes, FPIC violations, and settler colonial violence. Climate justice is about much more than carbon emissions. If we really want to create a just transition and a sustainable future, we have to take into consideration the harm done by these companies outside of just the pure numbers of carbon emissions. And then also, I know other folks on this panel are going to talk more about this later and also know more about it than I do, but it is worth noting that in July of this year, so just a few months before the divestment announcement, UTAM transferred management of U of T's pension fund, which is $10.2 billion, to the newly formed UPP, or University Pension Plan. This is a joint fund with Queen's University and the University of Guelph, and it is not subject to the divestment commitment. So hopefully now that two of the three members, U of T and the University of Guelph, have independently made divestment commitments for their endowments, hopefully there will be some more leverage to divest the UPP, but that is an ongoing fight. So if we want to look for complete divestment at U of T, that will have to include the UPP, as well as three of the colleges, the federated colleges. That's Victoria College, St. Michael's College, and Trinity College, which each have their own endowments, and those endowments continue to invest in fossil fuels. Over the past few years, LEAP has started divestment campaigns at each of the colleges, especially at Victoria, where we've had ongoing contact with their Board of Regents and held a lot of actions there in the 2018 to 2019 school year. So now that the university itself is divesting its endowment, we're going to continue putting pressure on the federated colleges to do the same. We've also had a lot of conversations and really wonderful workshops with various student unions and groups, some of which have their own investments that they weren't necessarily aware of. A lot of times for student groups, there isn't a great understanding of how their investments work or how they manage their money. And so being able to start conversations about why divestment is important and how it can be relevant at different levels of university life has been really interesting for us. And of course, for LEAP, divestment at the university has always been just a first step towards climate justice. So we're looking to other ongoing movements for the future of our group and the future of our activism. The Banking on a Better Future campaign is run by divestment activists who are looking at Canada's five major banks, all of which are massive supporters and give huge amounts of money to support the fossil fuel industry. So Banking on a Better Future, it's called, is a youth-led movement to get those banks to divest and really hold them accountable if they are claiming to protect our futures, make sure that they're actually doing that. The Land Back movement centers Indigenous sovereignty within climate justice and other steps that we can take towards building a just transition, looking at labor, looking at the steps that need to be taken as a society, because the university divestment is a great step, but it is really just one step toward the path that we need to be working towards in terms of climate justice and moving away from fossil fuels. So this is the last in-person action that we did, which was part of Banking on a Better Futures campaign. This was held outside of the RBC headquarters. And as it is, we are, you know, moving forward through the pandemic and starting to be able to safely get together in person again. We hope to keep holding institutions accountable and keep moving away from fossil fuels. And I think that is the end of my presentation. So I will pass it off to Professor Paul Downs.
Wow. Well, thank you, Rivka. That was amazing. I'm not sure Paul or I need to say anything. You covered everything. Great presentation. Thank you so much. But because we're professors, I'm sure we'll come up with something to say. So, Paul, over to you.
Thank you, Matt. Exactly. You got it right. Rivka did such a great job. She covered so much ground there very clearly and comprehensively. I will maybe just underline a few of the things that Rivka said and perhaps fill in a little bit of detail here and there. But and then hopefully we can move on quickly and get to the discussion eventually after Matt has spoken. But let me just go back and reiterate a couple of things. One is that I am, in addition to being a professor, I'm part of a group called Divestment and Beyond, which is a group of faculty, staff, and students who have been trying for a number of years now to persuade the university to divest from the fossil fuel industry in both the pension plan and the endowment plan. And as Rivka mentioned, one of the things that happened along the way is that the university decided to change the structure of its pension plan such that the plan will be merged with plans from Queen's and Guelph and maybe Trent eventually. And this means that to a certain extent, the university gave over authority and control over the pension plan to a new entity. And in that sense, we're able to wash their hands of the divestment of the pension fund. But that's part of the work that, that we're at Divestment and Beyond, we're engaged in very heavily, is trying to get this new pension plan to agree to rigorous and clear divestment principles. And that's ongoing work that we can talk about a little bit later. So if we come back to U of T and the announcement that was made the other day about the divestment of the endowment, I just want to say a little bit more about that. Rivka also mentioned that, and I just want to just put a slide up here just for a moment, just to try and emphasize a point. So if you will just bear with me while I do that. Here we go. So this is what I wanted to sort of emphasize here. When the president announced that the endowment would be divested from the fossil fuel industry, he made this distinction that many people won't be fully aware of. Rivka mentioned it, but because we're talking 101 today, I thought I would emphasize this. He said that they would be divesting the direct investment portions of the endowment portfolio within 1 year, and the indirect by 2030. The direct investment portion of the endowment is about 8% of the endowment. So that means that what the president announced was that 8% of the endowment would be divested from the fossil fuel industry within a year, 92% by 2030. And although we have to celebrate the fact that the word divestment was uttered by the president, that he managed to get that word out, and that has some symbolic value, certainly, we immediately have to underscore the fact that this is a very, very modest announcement. The idea that 8% of the endowment portfolio will be divested within 1 year, 92% will not be divested perhaps until 2030. That's too slow. That's not good enough. Why the distinction? Why does the president make this distinction between direct and indirect investments? Rivka also touched on that. The fact that direct investments means that the University of Toronto is directly capable of dropping those investments, changing those investments, picking and choosing those investments. The other 92%, they hand over to a series of third-party managers who will then put baskets of investments together and then report back to UTAM on the success or failure of those investments. And the University of Toronto has long maintained that that system is too complex and too difficult to interfere with, and therefore, it's too difficult to divest the indirect portion of the endowment plan. Our argument, and I'm sure Leap's argument too, all along has been that complexity is not a good enough excuse for avoiding the climate crisis and for avoiding your responsibilities around the climate crisis. If the University of Toronto is serious when it says that the climate crisis is the greatest challenge facing humanity today, then it has to take charge of those indirect investments. It has to be able to be willing to say, we will hold those 30 third-party managers to the same rigorous divestment standards as we use for our direct investments. And if those third-party investors cannot assure us that they will take investments out of the fossil fuel industry, then we will have to drop them and use other investment managers. But the university is not willing to do that. The university has decided that its return on its assets is more important than taking the climate crisis seriously. So unfortunately, for many of us at Divestment and Beyond, the president's announcement was really far, far too little, far too late. And we have to make that point, not just because we're not willing to recognize some kind of success when it comes along, but because the fact remains that 92% of the endowment is still exposed to the fossil fuel industry, and the pension plan, which is enormous, at this point in time is still exposed to the fossil fuel industry. So there's a lot of work to be done. Also, in the same announcement, President Gertler used this phrase. He says, UTAM will commit to achieving net zero carbon emissions associated with the endowment portfolio by no later than 2050. Why does the president and many other people use this phrase net zero? Why don't we just see zero? Why do we so often see that phrase net zero rather than absolute zero or simply zero? I think this is one of those areas where certain investors have become very good at using certain language to disguise their continued investment in fossil fuels and the fossil fuel industry. Because net zero really means that if it's possible to find ways to offset carbon emissions, then we will be able to continue to generate greenhouse gases, continue to invest in the fossil fuel industry. So NET really holds open a door to the possibility that some kind of fantastic technological solution will come along that will allow us to continue to emit greenhouse gases. Our position, and I think the position that many people want to take, is that the word zero is a meaningful word here. Zero carbon emissions means zero. Net is always the sign that some kind of obfuscation is entering into the picture. And so we have to be suspicious of the language that investors use, that unfortunately that President Gertler uses, and we need to really insist on truly zero carbon emissions if we take the crisis seriously. The other thing that Rivka mentioned that we've been very insistent about at Divestment and Beyond, and I think is a crucial part of the whole divestment movement, is this larger question of investment transparency and accountability. Because in some ways, the whole divestment movement is part of a larger responsible investing movement that says, in general, investors need to be more transparent about where money is going, who they're investing in. You as a worker with a pension plan, you as a student at a university with an endowment, you have the right to know where your money is being invested. And for many, many years, University of Toronto has been a leader in concealing where money is invested, either from the endowment or the pension plan. And we know that money gets invested in private prisons, in the fossil fuel industry, in industries that are engaged in all sorts of unethical behavior around the world, exploitation of child labor, exploitation of indigenous peoples. All of these behaviors are hidden behind the concept that investments should be concealed, that there's a certain fiduciary duty to conceal investments from members of plans or universities. We have to fight back against that, and the divestment movement is part of that fight. It's a fight to say, we want to know where money is going, we want to follow money, and we want investors to be absolutely transparent. The University of Toronto needs to commit to the fact that all its investments in its endowment from this day on will be transparent and available to members of the university to look at and to be able to evaluate where the money is going. And President Gertler did not commit to that in the announcement, and that's something else we have to push him on. At any given moment, it should be possible for a member of the University of Toronto to say, where is the endowment fund being invested? Even if the list of companies in which the university is invested comes 6 months after the purchase, because some investors say they need a bit of a time lag in order to protect important financial information, there's really no argument against revealing who the companies and industries are that the University of Toronto Endowment is invested in. And I think as the university begins its new big campaign, which it launched yesterday, the bicentennial campaign to increase its endowment funds enormously. This is a campaign you will hear about over the next few years repeatedly. You will see banners and posters. And I think we all need to push back and say, number one, we want full transparency about where the money that is raised in the bicentennial campaign is being invested. And we need to tell donors, potential donors, to ask that their investments be transparent and be shared with the University of Toronto community. That's going to be an important part of the work going forward, I think. One of the things that the university has done repeatedly with the pensions plan is to suggest that they have a fiduciary duty to make money to provide employees with a good pension. And that argument is going to be made by this new pension plan too. So one of the things that divestment activists have to do is find ways to push back against this argument that investing in the fossil fuel industry is the fiduciarily responsible thing to do. Because it's become increasingly clear that that's not the case, that investing in the fossil fuel industry risks stranding assets, it risks losing members' money going forward as more and more public policy turns against the fossil fuel industry, as the public turns against the fossil fuel industry, and as alternative energy industries grow, it's becoming increasingly untenable to argue that pension plans need to be invested in the fossil fuel industry. So we at Divestment Beyond plan to continue to up our efforts to really pressure the new pension plan to divest. And we are helped in that work by people at Guelph and at Queen's and hopefully at Trent too. So that's one of the things that we're going to be doing going forward. So why don't I just leave it there for now, and I'll let Matt say a few things, and then I'd be happy to join in a conversation, ask questions about what our group is doing and about some of the things we've talked about in the Q&A session. But I'll just leave it there for now. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Paul. So one of the pitfalls of going third on a panel with two dynamic and very knowledgeable speakers is that they took almost everything that I want to say. And so I will, but again, this is a problem that I can work to overcome. I actually want to make 3 points, and so I will be relatively brief, but 3 points that I think will touch on things that Rivka and Paul said, but maybe put them in a little bit of a broader context, and I hope that it will form some fun for our discussion. So I want to make 1 point about the broader context of U of T's divestment decision that was announced 10 days ago now, and then a couple of points about what's next, both for U of T and the movement around divestment here, but then also sort of a bit larger or broader in terms of where divestment goes, right? And the first point is an observation. What we've seen actually is an incredibly fast phase shift or nonlinear change in the divestment space, in the financial sector, amongst institutional investors, which I would include U of T as an institutional investor, pension funds, hedge funds. So what we've seen, and Rivka's calendar or timeline of divestment at U of T actually could be reproduced writ large for the divestment movement. It's been a long, slow slog for many years in the movement, writ large and at U of T. Essentially, it started with some first movers, relatively small universities and colleges, especially in North America and the UK. But you had a lot of major institutions, U of T included, choosing to not divest and spending a lot of time, energy, and resources actively opposing divestment, right? And so you had this sort of first movers, and you had a lot of the social movement and activists pushing for divestment, and you had a lot of resistance, especially from major universities, from Yale, from Harvard, from U of T. But the momentum was sort of bubbling there underneath, and it was built. And you started to see a trickle of divestment announcements. You started to see them in institutional investors outside of academia, right? And so momentum built slowly, and you know, with times of COVID, we all sort of painfully understand nonlinear change more than we ever have before, right? But you had this long, slow buildup, and then suddenly, I would say in the last 6 to 9 months, we've seen a wave of divestment announcements, right? Sovereign wealth funds, hedge funds, even laggard universities like Harvard and now U of T are suddenly committing to divestment. And this is part of a larger shift, at least in rhetoric, in the financial sector as a whole, towards sustainable finance, towards net zero announcements within the financial sector. Just last week in Glasgow, Mark Carney announced an alliance of financial sector actors worth a combined $130 trillion, with a T, trillion, who have committed to aligning their lending and their business operations with net zero goals, right? This would have been unheard of 3 years ago. It's good. This is good. It's an example of how things can change very quickly. It's one of these things where at least, I mean, I won't speak for everyone that's been working on divestment, but for me, it kind of felt like we were banging our heads against a locked door each day. And then suddenly we woke up one day and the door was open, right? Quite literally, we had a divestment and beyond meeting the day before President Gertler made his announcement to talk about what new pressure strategies we should apply, because we sort of had a lull over the summer with the censure and with COVID. We're like, oh, we got to start ramping up the pressure on divestment again. And then suddenly the door was open. And I think we're seeing that happen in a lot of different places. The financial sector is moving very quickly, at least rhetorically, right? It is becoming now commonplace and the norm for the financial sector to be committed to sustainable finance, to be committed now to net zero pledges, net zero by 2050 pledges, right? And in Q&A, we can talk all about net zero by 2050, if people are interested, both in the financial sector and beyond. Right, and so I think we need to recognize that U of T's announcement is part of what has become a sort of rhetorical wave of divestment, right? Divestment announcements and net zero by 2050 announcements. And that this is a significant shift in what is expected out of the financial sector and institutional investors, right? That they should at least be committing themselves to making these announcements, committing themselves to divestment, committing themselves to net zero pledges. But then, of course, the question is, what now and what next, both for U of T and sort of more broadly in the financial sector and with divestment movements? It's kind of one of those things where you suddenly, you know, the U of T announces divestment, you wonder what you do, right? And I think that that's happening all over because things have started to move so quickly after they moved so slowly for so long. I want to put two things on the table, and I think that this is really in line with what Rivka and Paul laid out in terms of some of the next steps. Two things on the table for what's next, both for U of T and divestment, people interested in divestment around U of T, and writ large. And the first is accountability and transparency. It is excellent that everyone now feels compelled to make announcements about divestment and sustainable finance and net zero goals for the financial sector, right? I think that having that normative shift should not be downplayed. But announcements are easy, right? And the next step is actually going to be harder for the divestment movement, both at U of T and at and writ large, because now it turns to being vigilant to make sure that it's not greenwashing, as Rivka pointed out, right? And it's much harder to be critical in some ways, once someone has said, we're doing what you asked us to do, right? And so it's a harder task to stay on task, to be vigilant and critical about what the implementation looks like. And two things I think we really both, again, specifically and more broadly, need to be paying attention to. And the first is timelines. 2050 pledges are a nice rhetorical flourish. It fits with the Paris Agreement. There's a nice symmetry to it. But I think what people too often forget is that for 2050 pledges to be meaningful, that means action has to start yesterday, or at least today, right? Because climate change, and I said this in an earlier panel, climate change is a bathtub problem. Until you turn off the faucet, right? The cumulative emissions continue to grow, right? And so we can't say that, you know, we're going to be net zero by 2050 and say, okay, in 2045 we'll take care of this because emissions will have raised significantly by then. Net zero by 2050 means a heck of a lot of action now, right? And that's why, and Paul mentioned the 2030 and Rivka mentioned the 2030 deadline for removing our indirect assets at U of T from fossil industry, and a 2050 goal for net zero is too long, right? That's too slow. And the second is implementation. And I think the key for implementation, is, and this is again something that both Paul and Rivka mentioned, is about transparency, right? Do we know where investments are going, right? Do we know where investments are going? Because it's only through knowing where investments are going that observers can see if this institution and other institutions that are claiming to move in a positive direction on these issues are following through, right? Are following through with their pledges. Are their targets being met? And it's actually through transparency is the only way we can also decide whether the targets are stringent enough and whether they should be ratcheted up, and they need to be ratcheted up over time, but how? And this, I want to remove the question of intentions, right? Remove the question of intentions. Let's put aside intentions. If we ascribe everyone with good intentions, we still need pretty rigorous monitoring and pressure to ensure follow through to big announcements, precisely because the forces of inertia are very strong, right? What we're talking about is having to make relatively large changes to how we think about investment at U of T and in the financial sector and what movements of capital are for. And that is changing that and overcoming the inertia means that we have to be vigilant about how the announcements are being implemented, right? And that, again, that's independent of intentions. And so there's, I think, a real role still for the divestment movement, for climate justice activists to really be monitoring and worrying about accountability and transparency moving forward. And the second, and this is again going to dovetail with things that, that Paul and especially Rivka mentioned, is that we have to realize, and I think across the movement has to realize, and I'm not speaking for the movement, I wouldn't say that I'm sort of fully ensconced in the movement. I've certainly tried to be active here at U of T. But we have to realize that divestment is a means, not an end. Right? Divestment is a means, not an end. Certainly, divestment is about challenging the social license of the fossil fuel sector and the power of the fossil fuel sector. And it certainly is a wake-up call for the financial sector to the necessity and possibility of change, right? But the responsibility now that people have started to agree with the divestment movement is the responsibility to work even harder to ensure that capital movements are not just out of the fossil fuel sector, but in the service of something else, in the service of just transition, in the service of climate justice. Because if we're going to rely on capital movements to help us address climate change, to help deal with the climate emergency, to help deal with the kind of massive societal transformations that we need to a low carbon just society, right? If we're gonna rely on capital movements for that, we can't be just saying, okay, get out of fossil fuels, get out of the fossil sector. We have to be talking about and having a societal conversation about where financial capital moves and with what motivations, right? And this is true with individual institutional investors like U of T, but also more broadly, right? I think we need to think differently, and this is going back to what Paul said, think differently about fiduciary duty. Think differently about how investing strategies that are, and this is to take some language announcement, investment strategies that are climate positive and investment strategies that are designed to catalyze transformation to just and equitable societies. The strategy has to be that about not just maximizing returns financially. We have to think about returns differently, right? It means using the strategy around finance is about realizing shared and espoused values. And let me just put out there that, you know, one of the counter arguments to the things that I'm talking about here is, well, investment decisions shouldn't be political, right? And this was in fact one of the early rejections of divestment requests, to say that investment decision, we shouldn't be playing politics with the money of the institution. The flip side of that, or the counter to that argument, is that not acting in alignment with one's values is also a political statement. Putting financial return as the only and highest priority is a political statement. Investing and continue to invest and upholding the social license of the fossil fuel sector, no matter what it does, is also a political decision. It's just that one is a political decision that's steeped in inertia and the status quo, and one is a political decision that seeks change towards a more just and equitable society, and one that is low carbon, right? And so I think that the big responsibility now for the divestment movement, both at U of T and writ large, is to continue to make the connections to climate justice and to talk about divestment as a means to movement of capital and the prioritization of investment strategies that aligns with and in fact enhances efforts towards climate justice. That's what leadership is going to be moving forward out of this wave of divestment, as far as I'm concerned. And here at U of T, we love to talk about leadership, right? We failed to lead, the university failed to lead on divestment, right? We are coming in at the tail end or in the midst of a wave. We were not at the beginning of it. But one of the great things, maybe one of the only good things about a problem like climate change, as complex as climate change is and as long-lasting and as challenging as it is that there's always another chance, always another opportunity to lead, right? There are no lack of opportunities to lead on climate change. And we can start today. And I hope we take it this time. And that's my wish for Divestment and Beyond, but also for the University of Toronto. With that, we have about 45 minutes for Q&A. I noticed that there have been, I want to sort of thank my fellow panelists, I noticed that there are already two questions. Beth asked, how much is in the endowment fund? And I already responded to that, but I'll just tell everybody. It's about $3 billion in U of T's endowment. Milan asks a very challenging question here. Could the lack of recent activist agitation partly explain the decision to divest, I assume you mean at U of T, by reassuring the university's financial managers that their control, expertise, and compensation are not threatened? This is a good question. We've been, people that are interested in the, people in the divestment community have been sort of trying to figure out what went into the decision, especially the timing of the decision, right? I'm not sure, I don't know, right? As recently as this summer, the administration was still sort of very vigorously, or at least very vocally, through campus media and webinars and things along these lines, defending the decision to not divest. And so it's tough for me to say. I don't know, and I'd be interested to hear what Rivka and Paul have to say about Milan's question there.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts. I think it's a really excellent question, first of all, and one that I myself have been kind of thinking about over the past few weeks. As we people in Divestment and Beyond have been kind of speculating about the various factors that could have gone into the timing of this decision. Because, like I mentioned, all of the reasoning that was given in Merrick Gerloo's announcement is all factors that have been true for years. And so the question of why now is very much on everyone's mind. I think it's entirely possible that this was part of it. Something that I've talked a lot about with other student activists specifically on campus is sort of walking the line or trying to find a balance between being, going through more official avenues of change making, things like filing petitions, the FIPA request that we did, and trying to make connections with people in power at the university and advocate for change that way, or trying to be, louder and more disruptive and using more of the nonviolent direct action, holding rallies and things like that we would do before the pandemic, and trying to make a big fuss and raise awareness that way and put pressure on the university more externally. And we haven't really come to an answer about which of those are most effective, because the more, internal avenues of advocacy are often really ineffective, as we've seen over the past decade with divestment at U of T. It's often very easy for the university to just say, oh, you would like to make a change in this one specific place that you don't have any power over? No, thank you, we're not gonna do that, we're not interested. And then what else can you do from there? But on the other hand, the idea that activist agitation and then the university responding to that would result in maybe an insecurity in the financial managers at UTAM or in the administration, worrying about the threatening of their control, expertise, and compensation, as Milan says here. So I think that, in Merrick Gerloo's announcement, as frustrating and I would even say condescending as we found it, he did acknowledge that student passion and advocacy for divestment was a factor in some way in this decision. So I don't think we should completely write off more disruptive forms of protest. But I do also think it's important to remember that that isn't always what yields direct results. I think that in the long term, you know, these decisions aren't going to be made if they're not put on the table. And in order to be put on the table, people have to understand what we're talking about and why divestment is important. And so I think that it, yeah, requires things like divestment and also just social justice movements more broadly require a whole collection of tactics. And you have to sort of at it from all sides, because otherwise nothing's going to change.
I wanted to just maybe go out on a limb and reiterate something I said in my presentation in terms of Milan's question. I have a theory that the reason that President Gül decided to make this announcement now is because it coincides almost exactly with the launch of their new donor funding campaign. This is a huge campaign. It's going to be called the Bicentennial Campaign, because I think they're hoping to have it, the end of the campaign, coincide with the Bicentennial of the University of Toronto. And they have themes that they are associating with this campaign, which you will be hearing about over the next few years. Seven themes for their campaign. And here are three of the themes: healthy lives, sustainable future, and the next generation. Now, I don't know how you can go out all over the world and all over the city of Toronto asking people to donate money to the University of Toronto under the theme next generation, sustainable future, and healthy lives, while your endowment is simultaneously invested in the fossil fuel industry. So I think they decided that was going to be a terrible PR issue, and they said, what's the minimum we can do to be able to say that we have divested from the fossil fuel industry and therefore disable that criticism which could undermine our endowment campaign? And so this is what they did. They said, we'll divest from the direct investments in 1 year and the rest in 10 years. So I really think we have to push back against that. As soon as this campaign gets underway, we have to take their own themes and push back against them and say 92% of this endowment that you're trying to grow will continue to be funding the fossil fuel industry for another 10 years.
Excellent. We have another couple of questions are starting to come in here. So let me put this one out. Not sure how it works with the university, but if those who make the endowments are in agreement with divestment, would they not be able to put pressure on the university to speed up the process? I assume you are meaning about those who make donations to the endowments, right? Because the people that manage the endowments are within the sort of university administration. UTAM is University of Toronto Asset Management Corporation works within the university. But yes, those who make donations to the endowments, could they put pressure on the university to speed up the process? I think yes. And I think there's going to be, has been and will continue to be growing interest amongst donors about where money that they are investing in the university is going to be invested, right? And I think that that's an important sort. In fact, this is one of the leverage points that a number of divestment movements have talked about trying to pull to move universities to act on divestment. Other thoughts on the panel?
Yeah, I agree with everything Matt said. And I think that if people are looking for ways to get involved, as soon as you hear about a donor giving money to the University of Toronto or even being approached, I think people should be writing to them directly, because oftentimes these donors don't realize themselves what's going on until they're told about it. And they will be told by the university, oh, we're divesting from the fossil fuel industry, don't worry, your money's in good hands. But I think it's up to us to try and alert the donors and say, you know, ask questions about where your money's going, and, you know, make transparency and responsible investing a condition of your donation. I think that's a good way to go.
Rivka, did you want to add? If not, that's no problem.
The only thing I would add is that this is why it's so important to be talking about this, even though, you know, some might say, oh, UNC's already said they're going to divest. Why are we still talking about divestment? Because we need to be holding them accountable to this timeline. You know, I'm going to be an alumnus very soon, and so I, you know, will be making considerations about whether or not to donate to U of D, and I will definitely be considering, you know, their investment policy as a factor. And, you know, I'm one person, but there are many more people who I know, who I have conversations with about U of D's investment policy and about the fossil fuel industry. And hopefully having those conversations and people who learn about divestment having those conversations as an ongoing thing rather than something that we put in the past now that they've made this one commitment will, you know, make it a continue the pressure for U of D to be considering it.
Great. So another question, are there some good examples of investment transparency, like other universities or institutions who have made public detailed breakdowns of where their funds go? I know that Queen's University is much better than U of T. There is a complexity involved in getting breakdowns of indirectly managed funds, right? But, and so I don't know of great examples of those, but I think that there are other institutions that are much better about at least saying who's managing those funds. And then the transparency question has to be about putting pressure on the fund managers, the managers of managers, to be transparent about where they're investing our funds. But Queen's University has a pretty good breakdown available of its investments. Rivka, as Leap looked into sort of best practices for university transparency?
Queens is the example I was going to give as well. I don't know of any other great examples, except for when it comes to smaller schools. I think, especially in the U.S., smaller colleges have a much better record when it comes to investment transparency. I have a friend who goes to Carleton College in Minnesota, not the Carleton in Ontario, there was a very brief divestment movement because almost as soon as their campaign got started, the school said, oh, actually, here is a publicly available breakdown of our investments, and they committed to divestment and were able to do it on a much shorter timeline just by nature of it being a smaller school. And I think that's true in Canada as well. But as we have seen from other schools with a, you know, 3-year or 5-year timeline, this process can be much more transparent and much shorter, even at the big scale of the amount of money that you would be investing.
Yeah, I would just add, it's a good question, and it's actually given me another research project to go out and look for institutions that are more transparent. Because I know on a smaller level, we know it's the case. Even, you know, charities now increasingly, when they go out to invest money, want to use managers who will be fully transparent about where the money's going, and increasingly investment managers are offering that transparency on the smaller scale. And there's no real reason at the end of the day, other than an attempt to put profits over social justice for the kind of obscurity that these funds claim. So, but it's a great question.
All right, so next, Paul Hamel asks, the university plan suggests they will go beyond net zero by being a positive generator of clean energy, but there are still 23,000 tons still emitted, but there are 23,000 tons still emitted by 2050 and no capture technologies? What's up?
I think one of the things that Paul is directing our attention to here is the fact that the University of Toronto is planning enormous expansion of its campus over the same time period that's discussed in this divestment announcement. Almost doubling the size of the campus in terms of building space. And that is an enormous amount of building and growth that's going on that itself is going to generate an enormous amount of GHG. And there's no registration of that in the plan that the university is presenting for being a clean campus. And so I think this is a good question because it directs our attention to not only the kind of expansion that's going to be taking place and the emissions will be associated with that expansion, but who is that expansion for? And therefore, in other words, who is it that we are trying to reach with that expansion? And my suggestion is that we're trying to expand this university in order to grow its appeal to international students who are paying a huge fee to come here, and thereby turning the university into something closer to a private university, not a public university. And the more privatized this university gets, the less accountable it is to the people of Ontario, to the people of Toronto, to those who would think of the university as having a public social mission. And as a result, there's a tie-in, there's a close link between the increasing, creeping privatization of the University of Toronto and its lack of transparency around its own missions and its failure to properly divest. And these are questions that all have to be thought through together. And I think the question here asks us to do that, among other things.
Yeah, and I also think that it speaks to the real general troublesome nature of net zero pledges, not just University of Toronto. Like, this is not something that's restricted to the University of Toronto. Net zero pledges, everyone has one now, right? This is net zero pledges. It's becoming very quickly a norm to have a net zero pledge. And I know probably everyone on this webinar knows net zero, what net zero pledges are all about pretty well, but just in case, I mean, always have to remember that there's two parts to net zero, right? There's reduction of emission. The only ways you get to net zero are reducing your emissions or offsetting your emissions, right? And so good net zero pledges will have that balance be most of the work through reducing emissions, most of the work through decarbonization, getting off of fossil energy, with a very small part of the work being done by offsetting. So you're still going to have some combustion of fossil energy for some part of your operations, and you will offset that, right? By either in your own stuff, planting trees, carbon negative technologies, things like this, or you'll pay someone to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere through purchasing offsets, things along these lines, or you'll have a calculation where if you produce enough renewable energy beyond what you use in your own operations, that can be considered that you've offset what you have, right? So good net zero pledges are going to have the vast majority of the work on the decarbonization side, and will have credible offsetting strategies. What's not clear with most of the net zero announcements that we've seen is where the balance is on the net zero on these pledges. And what Paul's pointing out is that it's not entirely clear where U of T lands on this balance of what its net zero plans look like. And the other thing that I mentioned before is the only good net zero pledges are ones that include action that start at net zero by 2050 pledges are ones that include especially decarbonization action that begins today. Rivka, I'll give you a chance to weigh in if you wanted on that question.
I do not have anything to add. I think you both covered it very well and also have much more expertise about the breakdown of net zero plans than I do. So thank you for your answers.
Okay, so Milan has another question here. And I do actually want to say that the divestment decision was also a victory for Milan. Milan was a student activist on 350 and was one of the sort of main drivers behind the petition, the original petition to divest. And so this is, he's been long and hard at work at this, on this issue. He asks us, can anything be done to enhance the delegitimization of the fossil fuel industry from the U of T's announcement? It doesn't talk about their deception campaign or Indigenous right, the fossil fuel sector's deception campaign or Indigenous rights violations. Right? Does, in other words, can we up the political value in terms of the social license or removing the social license from the fossil fuel sector, right? Given that divestment announcements are political, what can we do to make it more effective politically and to really get at some of that delegitimization of the fossil fuel industry? Rivka, what's Leap thinking on these lines?
Yeah, Leap has been thinking about media narrative a lot. The first thing we did, well, that's not true. The first thing we did after we heard the announcement was schedule a Zoom call so that we could all sort of respond and start to process just with each other, because it was a huge surprise to us. But the second thing we did after that Zoom call, or sort of out of that, was write up a press release about our reaction and sort of as student activists where we were sitting with both the announcement itself as well as how it was framed and how it was phrased. And we did include talking about these sort of other elements of harm that are done by the fossil fuel industry that were not acknowledged by U of T's announcement and by its commitment to divestment. And since, yeah, so we sent out that press release to various publications, and we've also been, I've been doing some interviews with different Canadian newspapers, and I know a few other people as well have been. Julia Da Silva, who was one of the main student organizers with LEAP for a number of years, has been on a podcast and been interviewed by various journalists as well. So in all of this, you know, media attention that we're now getting as a result of U of T divesting, because, you know, that's the whole point of divestment, is that U of T is a major institution with major sway in terms of what people think about various industries and various societal factors. But now that people are paying attention to what U of T has to say about fossil fuels, it's really important for us, since people are paying attention to us now, to bring up that it's not just about carbon emissions from fossil fuels, it's also about the violations of Indigenous rights and of, yeah, treaty rights, as well as the deception campaigns and the lobbying that is done by fossil fuel companies. We want to be bringing all of this to the forefront of the conversation instead of just being an afterthought or not mentioned at all, as it was in President Gerber's announcement.
Paul?
Yeah, not much to add on. I mean, unfortunately, I think that Milan's question says, is there anything that the announcement does to help delegitimize the fossil fuel industry? I'm afraid not. I mean, the truth is that President Gertler is very, very reluctant to single out the fossil fuel industry for any kind of real criticism. So the language that he uses in this announcement and elsewhere often tries to shift responsibility away from the fossil fuel industry, even while referring to this as a global threat or as a significant risk to humanity. Nevertheless, I think I don't quite understand why, but he does seem to be very reluctant to ever call out the fossil fuel industry or hold it accountable. But that's what we have to do, I guess.
Yeah, those are great. I don't have anything to add on those. I think those are both sort of fit with how I would understand it as well. Does anyone else have any other questions? I see in the chat there's some interesting suggestions for moving forward and some resources. I also don't suppose that, oh, there we have one. How should we respond to potential backlash such as petro-nationalism? Petro-nationalism, and I think that this is, you saw some of this with the Yellow Vest protests that started in France, but then there was a big caravan of the, this was pre-pandemic, I almost don't remember it, caravan in Ottawa, and certainly this would be a very different discussion if we were at the University of Alberta, and the sort of relationship between Alberta and the rest of Canada, or at least Alberta and the federal government around this, it's a very different discussion. So, Paul, Rivka, what do you have some thoughts about backlash here?
I'm not the most well-versed in the counter-arguments from people who are coming from ideologies like petronationalism, but I do have a few friends, one of whom is actually very much involved in climate justice, and while he was at U of T, was really involved in the fossil fuel divestment movement, who are from Alberta and have sort of tried to explain how different the culture is there around the way people think about climate and about fossil fuels. And I think it's really important that this is when we have to move our talking points beyond just divestment and the negatives of fossil fuels and talk about a just transition and talk about reinvestment and sort of frame it in a bigger picture way. so that we're not just saying, oh, fossil fuels are bad and we're taking money away from them, but also we're putting money towards the future and towards other, you know, job possibilities and looking into things like a Green New Deal and ways to build further job opportunities. Like I said, I am not the most well-versed in the details of the politics of that, but I think that when we get backlash for, you know, for being too negative or too damaging to people whose livelihoods are dependent on the fossil fuel industry, we have to make it clear that, you know, this isn't just about power, it's about people, and it's about putting people first and creating a just transition that really takes into account the well-being of everyone.
I think you're much more knowledgeable about that than you give yourself credit for. To me, that's an excellent answer. I think just transition is absolutely the answer there. And this is kind of, as a political scientist, this is what scares me a little bit about how fast the financial sector has decided to move. Because capital can move very, very quickly, right? And capital moves quickly without much consideration of the kind of disruption that capital movements can have. And there are many communities in Canada and other places that are very much dependent on the fossil fuel sector, and communities that don't have and that are not at fault, right? Not at fault in the same way that fossil fuel industry is at fault. And so building sort of support for decarbonization, building support for net zero, building support for climate action is about making sure that those communities who are going to be disrupted by these capital movements see themselves as able to live the good life in the low carbon future. And that takes work. That takes moving capital, not just out, as Rivka talked about, not just moving out of these communities and these sectors, but moving capital with a purpose such that those disruptions can be ameliorated, and such that we build the kind of economy in society where people in the fossil fuel sector see themselves flourishing.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. And just sort of to repeat, I think that the big pension funds and banks, I think we'll see them very suddenly and rapidly switch capital to other industries, and ordinary people working in the oil industry will just be left behind. And that's one of the sad things, is that the same people who are resisting the idea that there's a climate crisis will abandon whole communities of people at the drop of a hat when capital switches elsewhere. So yeah, I think those are great points. You're muted, Matt.
Shoot, I thought I was going to get through one presentation without doing that. Liz asks in the Q&A, could you speak a bit about best practices for reinvestment? Clean energy rush can harm indigenous rights and ecosystem health. So I'm curious about safeguards or metrics for evaluating reinvestments. That's an excellent question. Thoughts, panelists?
I just want to go first because I don't know very much about this, so hopefully other people can speak more to it. But I know that the student divestment campaign at UBC, which announced its plans to divest shortly before the pandemic, they have sort of pivoted to looking at reinvestment and how student activism can play into that. So we at Leap U of T have not had the chance to do that yet, since we were so focused on divestment up until now. But it is definitely something we want to look into going forward, because, you know, as we've seen, the university's priorities are not always aligned with Indigenous rights or with climate justice ideals. So it's a really important question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And of course, the last person in the world who should be speaking about best practices for reinvestment is an English professor. I mean, part of what's going on here is that our whole way of thinking about investing has to change. We have this very kind of lip service ESG language in a lot of investment policies now. But really, the extent of the thought around responsible investing is at such a limited state. And it's a complicated question, because you have to take into question things like you know, if I invest in this clean energy industry, is it also an industry that's taking wealth away from the global south and redirecting it to the north? Are the kind of industries I'm investing in, do they look very squeaky clean on the outside, but are they in fact all about consolidating wealth in certain small pockets? There are numerous issues involved in genuine responsible investing, and it's complicated. But we have the best, you know, the amount of money and thought that goes into business schools, investment banking, thinking about finance, that has not really thought about responsible investing is enormous. And that's part of the shift that's got to take place. And it means, among other things, saying that pension funds, for example, have to get over the idea that the only thing they have to do is maximize profits for their members. As long as the only goal that's considered to be acceptable for a pension fund is maximizing profits for members, then they're not going to invest responsibly. There has to be a principle of just investing that is not secondary to, but primary for the plan and for the members. And so that's, for example, one of the things we're pushing when we start to try and get members involved in a new university pension plan. One of the things we're doing is saying to all members, you need to put pressure on your investment plan, your pension plan, to really be transparent about your investments and explain and justify the decisions that you make. It could be a whole sea change in the way people relate to investing, but there'll be a lot of pushback. But I'm no expert on the best way to do this. So.
Yeah, and I don't think that I don't think the best practices have emerged. I'm not an expert on investment strategy either, but I don't think the best practices have emerged. And this goes directly to a question that Adriana just asked. Do you think that investment movement can help build confidence in new alternatives in engaging communities on where investment ought to go and who should be involved in deciding? I think that that's an excellent suggestion. I think that this is where the divestment movement has to move. Once everybody has said, yeah, we'll divest, well, that same energy has to go into the discussions about where capital should move, with what purpose, and under whose authority. Right. And that I think that's a societal discussion, not only a societal discussion, but has to be made by the stakeholders in all kinds of institutional investors. And Cynthia in the chat mentions that, you know, credit unions invest in local communities. And this is, I think, absolutely part of the discussion. I think we'll finish up here with a question from Steve Easterbrook in the Q&A, sort of to for each of us to reflect a little bit. Could the panel say more, and I think this would be a good way to sign off. Could the panel say more about what they've learned about how grassroots campaigning works and the theory of change that Rivka presented at the beginning?
I would love to talk more about this. This is the part of divestment work that makes me happiest to talk about and that I'm really glad to have learned a lot from. Not that I'm not appreciative of the knowledge I now hold about how U of T manages its investments, but that was not something I exactly planned on having in-depth knowledge of when I got to U of T. So the core, if I had to give a one-word answer, which I'm not going to because I talk too much, but if I had to give a one-word answer to this question, it would be collaboration. I think that what we've seen from LEAP is that even though, you know, the group LEAP has only existed from 2017 to 2021, we've seen multiple generations, if you want to call it that, of students come in and out. And that's the sort of unique thing about student organizing on a university campus, is that most people, you know, there's graduate students, there's people who are here for longer, but most people involved in LEAP are only students for 4 or 5 years. And often students don't get involved in any sort of climate work or social justice work until their third or fourth year. So there's a lot of turnover. And I think that the university administration knows that and often relies on it when they're making decisions about how to respond to student advocacy. We've seen almost a decade of fighting for fossil fuel divestment at U of T, and luckily we've had, you know, allies and advocates from faculty and staff as well. But in terms of the work being done from students, there has had to be this sort of carrying over of knowledge about how the institution works and about how investments work from one group of students to the next. And the best asset that we've had in continuing that fight has been our collaboration with other groups. So groups like Divestment and Beyond that include people who have been involved in this from the beginning. The Divest Canada Coalition that includes student divestment groups from universities across the country. Again, including people who have been working on divestment for years, people who have been a part of successful divestment campaigns that are now pivoting to look at reinvestment and where to go next from an investment activism perspective. And it's a really wonderful network that has a lot of resources for people who are coming into this with more, you know, less experience or a more limited understanding of what divestment can be and what leverage we have as students and what power we have against the university, you know, to leverage against the university and call for change. We've also at LEAP done a number of collaborations with other student groups over the years. One of my favorite things we did during the pandemic was holding a Progressive Clubs Fair online that we did in September of 2020, where we had about 24 different social justice groups and environmental groups on campus come together and do some recruitment for new students. But what it ended up being, sort of unintentionally, was a chance for everyone to pop into each other's little breakout rooms and get to know what other work is being done on campus in terms of advocacy and social justice work. And we've held events with Students Against Israeli Apartheid, the Equity Studies Students Union, talking about the intersections of fossil fuel divestment and the climate justice movement with other things that are happening, like the BDS movement, like Indigenous sovereignty, like work being done on campus for anti-racism, and how these things are all interconnected. And making those connections and doing those collaborations has, for me, brought so much more meaning to the work than just we have to stop investing in fossil fuels. Because we did have to stop investing in fossil fuels, and we have to keep holding the university accountable to that. But it only is, you know, meaningful and powerful work if we're connecting it to all of the other causes and all of the other people that care about creating a better future and a better university that is doing more good in the world. So working in solidarity with issues beyond just the climate crisis and collaborating with other groups and other people on campus besides just students has been the best thing for me about grassroots campaigning work. And in terms of the theory of change, it also is a great way to build pressure, because not everyone is gonna be getting directly involved in climate work or in divestment work. But if we're making these connections and talking to people who care about other issues and other causes, and then they also care about divestment, and we also care about the issues that they're advocating for, then there is more pressure on all of these fronts towards the university. And it is easier to build that momentum to put pressure on the university to make that change at a societal level. I said I would talk a lot, and then I talk a lot. Sorry.
No, that's fabulous. I mean, it's inspiring to hear you talk that way, Rivka. And I just wish that the way you felt about organizing was shared even more widely, because I think that the people who run this university really don't like grassroots activism. And I would say that they are, the governance model at the University of Toronto is determined to replace anything like grassroots activism with the kind of what I would call the artificial turf of governing council, which is the body that's supposed to represent us all and vote on policy at U of T, but it's really just a rubber stamp for a very small group of people who make all the decisions at this university. But I do think that those people are very afraid of bad press. They're very afraid of what organized students can do, especially students. Faculty, they seem strangely less intimidated by. But a small group of students who are well organized and determined and patient can really do quite a lot on this campus. But it does take time. And I applaud you for the work you're doing, because it's incredible and really it's vital to the life of this university as a university, not just as a corporation.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add. I think what the two of you sum that up better than I could say it. And So I think that's wonderful. And I would like to leave our panel or our audience with those inspiring words. I want to thank Rivka and Paul for really great presentations and a stimulating discussion. Thank the audience for great questions. I really appreciate you engaging in this conversation with us. Thanks to the Minden Symposium for giving us a time slot to talk about divestment, and the Minden family for supporting all of this. It's been a wonderful panel, and I wish everybody the best of luck moving forward on the beyond part of divestment and beyond. Take care and enjoy the rest of the symposium.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you so much, everyone. This has been really great to have this conversation.
Great. Bye-bye, Rivka.
Bye.